Session number 6125, reel 7.
Mr. Hale, tape 7.
Sometimes members of the working party, working down the go-downs, used to bring in certain items, which were usually, I don't know if all of it was handed over, but quite a quantity of what was brought in was handed over to the hospital for the hospital patients. When I was in hospital, there was one man suffering badly from dysentery and malnutrition, I remember, very well. He seemed to lose everything except his voice. He had a terrific voice, and you could hear him all over the building shouting. And he died. And when they carried him out, they weighed him. And I think he weighed something in the region of 48 pounds, which was just the weight, they told us, of his skeleton. And he was a very terrible sight to see. From all accounts, I never saw him, but I heard him, and quite a number of men died, really, not weighing, but very little more. But about this time, I suppose about 3-4 months on, we had the onset of diphtheria. It wasn't recognised for quite a time, because diphtheria is, we've learned, it's a children's disease, and we're told by the medical officers, was a children's disease, and the chances are that very few of us would catch it. But quite a number did catch it. In fact, we built up to a score of 5-6 a day were dying with diphtheria, plus dysentery, so we were losing some bad days, perhaps as many as 10 people were going down with either diphtheria, dysentery, and dying. The diphtheria people were put into a separate hut. This has been cleared out. And the people who nursed them were their own pals. And I can't help feeling that it was a type of bravery that very few of us have, that you'd knowingly go and nurse a pal who was dying of diphtheria, knowing that you would possibly be the next one on the list to go down with diphtheria. Arrangements were made that certain of the diphtheria patients were taken out from Champs-Yupo to a convent, and a few of these were taken out and nursed by the nuns, but it only prolonged the agony, because they had nothing to treat them with, and the majority of those that went out with the nuns were either died out at the convent or were brought back to die. There was no question of them being treated and convalescing and being returned as fully fit. About this time, one of my half a dozen very closest friends, he was the drummer and violinist of our band, came to me and said, Binny, that's my nickname. Binny, have a look down my throat. It's so sore. So, having always wanted to be a doctor, interested in general medical things, my pals got to know over the course of the years, used to come to me sometimes with their aches and pains. And this particular occasion, Bill Christie came and said, have a look down my throat, Bin. It's awful sore. So, I had a look down. Ever so red. I said, well, go to the cookhouse, see if you can get a little bit of salt and some more water in a mug or a tin or whatever have you, and gargle as best you can do. He went away. Next day, have another look down my throat. I had a look down. It was all covered in white patches. I said, badly ulcerated, Bill. I said, better go down to the MO. Bill went down to the MO. And I never saw Bill again. He had diphtheria. He was one of those that was taken out to the convent, so we were given to understand, and they brought him back. And he died of diphtheria in the prison camp. When we visited Hong Kong, my wife and I, in 75, and last year in 1980, I visited Bill's grave in the Sai Wan Cemetery in Hong Kong, and I've got a photograph of the grave taken with my wife and I alongside of it. And time went by, went along, I suppose, until around about, it was in October of that year, following captivity. And working parties had been going out to Kai Tak, preparing the aerodrome from what it is today. And we learned that there was to be a draft of certain personnel to be taken to, as we were given to understand, Japan. And I was among the numbers called for, and it was in October, and we were paraded outside one of the huts by the seafront, and were glass-rodded by a Japanese medical personnel. Well, glass-rodded consisted of the insertion up the back passage of a rod about 6 inches long, a glass rod, which was notched, something like a crochet needle, I suppose, little notches down a rod. This was inserted out the back passage, and that was then examined by the Japanese for dysentery. And we were also given an inoculation or a vaccination of some sort, which was supposed to be for cholera. And I don't think any of those who were selected were told that they were unfit to travel. But among the personnel that were selected for the draft, our command of our draft was Lieutenant Colonel Stewart of the commanding officer in the Middlesex Regiment, one or two Royal Scots officers, Commander Jackson, RN, a medical officer, and I suppose a dozen or so officers, and 1,800 NCOs and other ranks were examined. And in the fullness of time, well, after 2 or 3 days after medical examination, during that period we were kept segregated from the remainder of the camp personnel. And we were taken in lighters to a cargo ship anchored off in the harbour, called the Lisbon Maru. All Japanese boats were called Marus, and this particular one was the Lisbon Maru. And we were bundled down into the holds of this ship. There were three holds. I was in the middle hold, down to the all-up deck. That's the first deck down, and below us there was another deck. We were crowded in. We were crowded on board the boat, and we just lay on boards. I don't even believe there were even mattresses. There were buckets for latrines, spaced about 6 foot along the edge of the boards that we lay on. Below us, we were all Scots on the all up deck. Below us, in the depths, were I think the Middlesex regiments, mostly, and some Royal Scots. The regimental sergeant major, person name of I think RSM Lightbody, was also down below. And we, in fullness of time, we set sail from Hong Kong Harbour. We were allowed up to collect food, rice, which, and I believe there was meat. If I remember rightly, the rations on board the Lisbon Maru that were dished out to us were a bit better than we were getting in the camp. I think there was meat and some sort of vegetation with the rice. The toilets were fixed to the top deck in a manner that they were kind of wooden boxes, and you kind of squatted over the side of the ship in these boxes to perform your bodily functions. There was always a big queue for these because quite a number of people were having some types of very loose bowel movements. Dysentery, I feel, was very much still with us. And I suppose about the third or fourth morning out, about six o'clock in the morning, I should think, I was up top deck. I don't know, I think I was up there to try to get our ration of rice, when there was a terrific explosion, and Japanese heard it, all the personnel that are up top, heard it was all down below, and everyone was shouting out, torpedo, torpedo, and the Japanese opened fire, because he didn't open fire, we thought, well, there must be a ship off there, we must be shelled, and there was a sergeant of the Royal Scots himself standing there, and we could hear a kind of a swooshing noise coming towards us, and we just put our arms around each other and we just hung on to each other tight, and there's a big swoosh, and it went right under the, well, we feel that it went right underneath the boat. Must have been the second torpedo had been fired at us, and time went by, and there was a terrific lot of shouting and hollering, and they boarded the gangway over, so the hatchways were boarded over, and shut out all the daylight. A little came through between the boards that they put over, and then we could hear the tarpaulins being dragged over, so they had boarded us in, and tarpaulins were dragged over the top of us. So we knew that we were boarded down in a sinking ship, and morale was pretty bad. The latrine buckets, I remember, were getting filled up, slopping over from us onto the people below. People were doing their functions onto the people below. The stench and the heat was terrible. Dead bodies were beginning to appear or to be found, and nothing could be done about them. We tried to contact the Japanese interpreter, but they didn't want to know. And Colonel Stewart was in our hold and gave word that endeavours were to be made to break out. We couldn't get through the wooden hatchways. And Colonel Stewart got a knife passed up to the people near the hatchways, and some responsible person was given the job of cutting the tarpaulin from the inside, inserting a knife through the wood that had been passed over the hatchway to push a knife through the divisions of the wood, and they were cutting all through the tarpaulin, ready for any future breakout that could be arranged. We lay there in the dark for a good many hours, and suddenly there was a terrific lurch, and the ship seemed to take a nosedive forward. Colonel Stewart gave the word to break out. Break out was made, and shots were opened fire from the outside, and we were beaten back. Well, the first people out were beaten back by the shots that were trained on the entrance to the hold. The covers were again put over us, and the same thing obtained, if I remember correctly, of cutting being done without any interference from the Japanese. And the ship did another lurch, and again we got the order from Colonel Stewart to break out. This time a bigger breakout was made, and I had endeavoured to break out with the first lot and came back. And I came back to the place where I'd been laying. next to a pal of mine by the name of Sharrock, who had made no attempt to break out. And I said to him, Sharrock, I said, why didn't you break out? He said, I know I should never make it with these feet of mine. He said, you just go. I said, well, I'll, if another breakout, I'll help. He said, no, leave me. He said, I know, I shall make you go. So Colonel Stewart gave us the second order to break out, and I went through the hatchway this time. We had a better chance being on the orlop deck, the nose right underneath. So I was among one of the first lots of the second party to get out. As I came out of the hold, I went straight over the side. She was tilted, and practically water was lopping over. I went straight over the side and endeavoured to swim away from the ship and picked up a plank of wood. I was soon joined by two other people. The Japanese then started opening fire from various ships that were close around, and the people on either side of me were hit, and they sunk. They let go of the wood, and they sank. I had a shot. I was shot, apparently, in the foot, because when I was eventually picked up, I was bleeding from the foot. I was in the water, all in all, about 5 hours, I suppose. It's a job to estimate the time. It was fairly early morning. The Japanese ships around made no attempt to pick us up. There was a lot of shouting from the Lisbon Maru. It was still above water at that time. Just the top deck, she was sinking. After some hours in the water, we could see islands in the distance. Some of the better swimmers, I was not one of them, struck out for the islands. I was with one of the battalion swimmers, water polo players. He joined me on my plank of wood. We kept afloat until we suddenly spotted the Japanese were picking up people who were floating around. Up until then, they'd been driving their ships right through any mass conglomeration of men. A strange thing that struck me then, that the men who were, quite a number were ill and drowning, were crying out for their mothers. Something that sticks in my memory. But after some hours in the water, the Japanese started picking us up, and I pointed this out to my pal. He left me on the wood, and he steamed away for this Japanese boat. I followed them best I could. I'm not much of a swimmer. He went up the side of the ship with a rope. He was pulled up by one other person who'd been picked up, and a Japanese sailor lowered a rope, pulled my friend up. He went over the side of the ship, taking the rope with him. I can see myself in the water clinging to the side of the ship, saying, Bert, the rope, give me the rope. He turned round with this other chap, realised he'd taken the rope with him, threw the rope over to me, and he and the other chap pulled me up over the side of the ship. That's how I managed to get saved. We spent the rest of the hours going around from little group to little group, picking up personnel that were alive, until our deck was fairly crowded. It was only a small tug. And later in the afternoon, we were taken quite a long journey, several hours, to Wang Po in Shanghai. We were unloaded onto the quayside. I just had a shirt. So all I had on was from the collar down to the tail was slit. Some people were naked. Some people had life belts on. We paraded on the quayside. Armed Japanese guard was there. Interpreters there told us that we had far better we had commit suicide because our chances of getting away alive were limited. We were herded onto board a Chinese junk that was alongside the harbour. We were so crowded that we couldn't all sit down. Those that could squatted with the next person in between your knees in front. We were there for some hours. People were running with dysentery and passed over the heads of others into the corner where there was a bucket. When dawn broke, we were paraded again on the quayside and then marched to a Japanese freighter. Loaded on board that, same thing applies in the Lisbon Maru. I was on the all-op deck. And by that time, I developed a terribly sore throat. The medical officer was Lieutenant Jackson, RN. I found him, asked him to have a look at my throat. He examined it. Then he said, I think it's salt water that you swallowed. It should get better. We'd still had nothing to eat. It was estimated that we'd been 72 hours without, from the time the ship was torpedoed till then, to re-embarking on board the Japanese freighter. Some 72 hours had passed, still no meal. About 2 or 3 hours later, I suppose, as roughly as I can estimate, I went to Lieutenant Jackson again, asked him to have another look down my throat. He did. He said, kneel down. He looked down the throat. He said, you've got a classic attack of diphtheria. Go and sit over there. There's nothing I can do for you, old man. He said, you look very distressed. I said, well, it's the only life I've got. He said, well, there's nothing I can do for you. He said, you'll just have to go sit over there by yourself. Well, in the fullness of time, I was joined by two others, swollen throats, and three of us had the diphtheria. Towards dusk, Commander Lieutenant Jackson came over and said that he had some diphtheria serum which had been brought into the Hong Kong camp with the dysentery MNB 693 by the Japanese Padre, and that he was going to give the three of us the diphtheria serum, which would normally be a dose for one man. He was going to divide it by between the three of us on the off chance that this would save our lives. He took us up a deck and gave us, the three of us, the injection of diphtheria serum. Later we were taken to the top deck where we'd been joined by a fourth person. We were stretched on the deck and a drunken Japanese sailor knifed this fourth person to death. A Japanese soldier saw what had happened, took the Japanese person away who'd murdered this fourth person. The three of us were later taken onto the quayside. It was raining. And we were left on the quayside. The people on board the ship were disembarked. My pal came over to me, the band sergeant, Sergeant Olsey, came over, said goodbye to me as they were being re-embarked on another ship. They left us three were left, and in the early hours of the morning we were picked up by a Japanese truck and taken into a hospital in Shanghai, which was occupied by the Japanese. We were in turn taken into a clinic where we were put into a chair, which seemed like a dentist chair. Forceps were put in a, were used to strip the linings from the back of our throat, mucous membrane that had grown through the diphtheria. That was taken away from three of our throats. I, as I say, only had a shirt. One of my pals was naked. The other one had a life belt. We were put in a little room with three beds onto a duvet, still unwashed, covered in oil. A Japanese guard was put in there with us, and We remained in there for 3 weeks under Japanese guard. Never had a wash for the whole time, 3 weeks we were there. After 2 weeks, I developed dysentery, and I thought that was my lot. But the Japanese dosed us up with all sorts of vitamins. We did manage to, they did manage to convey to us that they were injecting us with vitamin B2, vitamin B12. There were Japanese wounded in there, to whom we were quite a novelty. They presented each of us with an egg. I remember that very well, the Japanese soldiers. They wished to give us a presento of an egg. When the first day they gave us rice to eat, we had nothing to eat it with, and they dashed out into the shrubbery and brought us back twigs to, in lieu of chopsticks, to eat our rice with. But I fortunately recovered from dysentery, and we were in there just 3 weeks, and they bought us Japanese clothing, made us get up, and we had no footwear. They gave us wooden clogs, which were, we just couldn't get them on our feet, so we had to walk barefooted down to a railway station. We were put on board a train, and we went down into a place which subsequently turned out to be Wusong Flats, and we joined the remnants of personnel that had been picked up from the various islands. In all, they started off with 33 people had been recovered, 33 included our three selves. Whilst we were there, 15 died of the 33, mostly of dysentery and malnutrition. They made us cremate our own bodies, the bodies of those who died, of course. And whilst we were there, in the road working were some service personnel who turned out to be Americans. We had a signaller with us by the name of Golding. He was able to contact them with the Morse code and semaphore, and we learned that they were in a camp not far away from us. They fed us reasonably well by their prison camp standards. And after being there, for about a month, they put us on a truck and took us to the Wusong prisoner of war camp where Sir Mark Young had been taken. Sir Mark Young was the governor of Hong Kong, and he had been in that camp, which was mainly an American camp, and they'd taken him away about a week, I suppose, before.